Maine's Political Pulse is made possible by listeners and by Lee Auto Malls, with a goal of donating 30,000 meals to the Good Shepherd Food Bank this December. Learn more at leeauto.com.
Welcome once again to Maine's Political Pulse. I'm Erwin Gratz, joined by Maine Public's Chief Political Correspondent Steve Missler and Senior Political Correspondent Mal Leary. I must say, one of the consequences of the freer flow of political spending over the decades is that it has created a much more diffuse collection of groups that seek to affect election outcomes, which, Steve Missler, I think leads us to Maine Momentum.
It does, yeah. So Maine Momentum, if you recall, was a social welfare organization that popped up in 2019 and began running a series of ads and holding a bunch of events, sort of town halls, that sort of thing. It was pretty clear at the time they were all part of this elaborate pressure campaign against Republican Senator Susan Collins, who was already under pressure, of course, because of votes she had taken during the Trump presidency, which has been well documented here. That group, of course, was very active, and it was pretty clear from the beginning that they were well-funded, but we didn't know who their funders were, and they wouldn't tell us. But there were some clues, and it turns out those clues were pointing us in the right direction, because just recently, a larger nonprofit organization known as the 1630 Fund published its tax returns for the part of the 2019 and 2020 years. What we saw was $3.8 million to Maine Momentum from this 1630 Fund, which has been active all over the country. They were active in the 2018 midterms, and then they were active in key Senate races across the country this year and in 2019. And of course, Maine was one of those key races. It's interesting to think about what they were doing, right? They were essentially a bridge from those difficult votes that Collins took until when the election campaign really, really heated up. And what they did was essentially bulldoze, I think, a path for those more conventional political action committees that actually do have to disclose their donors. But those action committees really didn't become super active until later on. So that Dark Morning organization, what I like to say, was kind of like they were softening up Collins, I think, so the big heavy hitters could come in later on. That's what we know. I did a story in 2019 that, you know, raised some questions about these links. And now that it turns out we were asking the right questions, they just weren't going to be answered until that tax return came out.
You know, it makes me kind of wonder whether or not, given what she just went through, Collins would have any stomach for campaign finance reform in this term.
What she pushes is disclosure. To what Steve's talking about goes back to the Supreme Court decision that allows these quote unquote dark money organizations to collect huge amounts of money and spend it and not have to disclose who their contributors are and in fact, how they spent the money. It will show up if it shows up in another report, as Steve mentioned, on another political action committee. She says that people should know where the money's coming from and how it's being spent. That gets around part of the concern in the Supreme Court decision, which was it was unconstitutional to put limits on how much an individual or corporation can spend. That leads to people like, both on the Republican and Democratic side, these incredibly wealthy individuals who go in and decide to spend hundreds of millions of dollars of their own money to influence races, and you have no idea that they're involved.
This Maine Momentum 1630 Fund sort of scheme, if you will, is really modeled after the Republicans and conservative activist groups. I mean, that was one of the tip-offs, honestly, is this the structure of the organization, the 1630 Fund, and then the Maine Momentum and everything else. It looked exactly like the Koch brothers and what they did with state-level organizations. They had this a nonprofit group that would funnel grant monies down to affiliates at the state level that looked like grassroots organizations, but they're really just part of this larger apparatus. That whole scheme has been vilified and criticized by Democrats for years. But I think at the end of the day, they made a decision that we can't leave ourselves out of this particular game. We've got to participate in this because it, you know, it shields the donors, the big money donors in some way, even though everybody seems to know where the money's coming from, at least on the Democratic side. You know, it's a dark money arms race. I think that's the best way to describe it. Democrats have finally gotten hip to it. But I think at the end of the day, it makes it harder for the public to understand what's going on and where that money comes from. And that, you know, that's all very important.
Well, folks may find this refreshing, but we're going to talk next about an election in which there was no discernible campaign spending, no political advertising, very few voters, but there is ranked choice voting now. We're talking about, obviously, the votes the legislature took this week as it convened for the constitutional officers.
Well, we got to remember that Maine is kind of unique in that those posts in many states are elected directly by the people or are appointed by the governor and confirmed by the state Senate. You know, the reality here is that the Secretary of State, the Attorney General, the State Treasurer, and the State Auditor are elected by a joint convention of the legislature. So your entire electorate is made up of the House and Senate together voting at a joint convention. Now, the Democrats in control decided to apply ranked choice voting to their nomination process and to the election process. And that resulted in a afternoon-long vote on the Secretary of State, where we started off with six candidates, and it took all five rounds before we finally got to Shenna Bellows being out Matt Moonen, current majority leader, to become the nominee of the Democrats to be Secretary of State. So it was an interesting process, and I can remember past years when we had contested races down the line with Treasurer, Attorney General. They would take long, but this process for one campaign took a good chunk of the afternoon.
Yeah, we had, of course, two of those positions, Attorney General and State Treasurer, going to be filled by the people who had them before, Aaron Fry for Attorney General, Henry Beck for Treasurer, and then there's the State Auditor, which we should not confuse with the rest of these, really.
That's right. The State Auditor is a statutory position, not a constitutional officer, and it's interesting in that it has a four-year term, as opposed to a two-year term. And Matt Dunlap, the current Secretary of State, was elected State Auditor for the next 4 years. And he's got to hustle in the next few months because there are minimum requirements of accounting expertise that he simply doesn't have, and he admits, but he's going to get them.
Let's move back to national politics. And here we're going to see, I guess, Steve Mistler, this is some indication of the growing impact of Twitter on politics in America.
Or maybe outsized impact, you know, in reality. But President-elect Joe Biden has, you know, begun to assemble his team, his cabinet, and he has nominated Neera Tanden, who is the director of Center for American Progress, as one of those positions. And so the problem is that Neera Tanden has been, like a lot of people who are politically active, very active on Twitter and very critical of Republican senators in particular, who she viewed as complicit or, you know, enabling the president's divisive conduct, which also just happens to have occurred a fair amount on Twitter. Now that's a problem because Republican senators are basically saying, we can't confirm her. She's radioactive. And, you know, she says mean things about us. And of course, I think Tanden has begun to realize that she might be in a little bit of trouble here. And the Daily Beast actually had a story about how she began deleting a bunch of these tweets, especially those that were directed at key Republican senators, of which Republican Senator Susan Collins is one of them. I think Tanden called her the worst at one point during the last 4 years. And Collins was asked about it by the Associated Press down in the Capitol and said basically, oh, well, I don't really know anything about her, but I've heard that she's very prolific on Twitter. So actually there's a lot of angst on the left about Tanden's nomination. So I'm not sure if that will actually pan out in a Senate vote necessarily, but you know, it is interesting to see Twitter elevated to this point where, you know, I don't know that most of the American public is even aware of what happens on there, nor should they care necessarily.
It goes well beyond Twitter. I mean, the whole social media fabric has changed campaigns. Somebody may post something on Facebook about somebody and it gets picked up in a screenshot and bingo, that person's in trouble politically. So it's the entire range of social media that is unfiltered and in many cases, as we've learned with the president, absolutely untrue.
There are some people who still think I'm a young guy, but I mean, I do remember once upon a time when members of Congress used to say about appointees to cabinet and agency positions for a new president that, well, you know, regardless of what we may think about them, we're going to let the president-elect have his team, have a chance for his team. But I guess in the era of hyper-partisanship, that has sort of gone away.
I picked this up from Senator Collins last week. I mean, she's saying, you know, she's going to give deference to who Joe Biden wants for his cabinet. But if the person's really not qualified, without defining what qualified means, then, you know, then she may not be able to support that person. And, you know, she wouldn't go into any examples, of course, but I think she was sending a message that many Republican senators are sending, and that is people that have been particularly critical of them may find out that they're not going to get very far in the confirmation process.
Last but not least, we'll talk a little bit about Roger Stone. Steve, go ahead.
Who knew that we would ever have the opportunity to talk about Mr. Stone on the Political Pulse? Longtime advisor to the president, who gave an interview recently on with a conspiracy theorist, Alex Jones, and basically alleged that there was proof that the North Koreans have dispatched boats with ballots to Maine, and somehow have participated in this elaborate, implausible plot to cheat the president out of re-election. This, of course, made a lot of rounds on social media, of course. But what is interesting about it, of course, is that, you know, if you're really going to smuggle a vessel here, you have to take it up the Penobscot River, as anybody who has seen The Hunt for Red October knows. You've got to do it up there. I don't really know why, you know, if this theory would even work out if the North Koreans ever were to try this, because why wouldn't they just go to the West Coast? I don't understand this at all, but I don't think we're meant to, quite frankly.
Senior political correspondent, Matt O'Leary, chief political correspondent there, Steve Missler. I actually saw The Hunt for Red October not a couple of weeks ago. Great movie. Sean Connery, Alec Baldwin, James Earl Jones, and Scott Glenn does a great job in that movie playing a submarine captain. So there you go. But Maine's Political Pulse is updated each Friday. You can hear most of The Pulse Sundays on Maine Public Radio's Weekend Edition. We also air excerpts on Monday's Morning Edition. Steve Missler composes a Maine's Political Pulse newsletter, which he posts Friday morning, and you can subscribe to at mainepublic.org. Thanks to our producer, Willis Ryder Arnold. Music is by Rob Holt. I'm Erwin Gratz, and thank you for listening.